Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. How do you win a showdown with a broken economy? Well, don't bring a knife to a gunfight.
Double-barreled shotgun with two cartridges, and the one cartridge is the stimulus package, and the other cartridge is the bank rescue plan.
We'll corral the details of both. Meanwhile, you may not want to open your brokerage statement, but your kid might.
This is a kid who's been listening to Steve Jobs' keynote address in its entirety since he was 8 years old.
It's a great time for budding Warren Buffetts. Plus, going from combat in Iraq to the unemployment line at home doesn't make a veteran feel like a hero.
At the end of the day, it's still better than getting shot at in a war zone. If you can get through that and you can get home alive, you can get through this job market.
That story and more coming up as we continue our coverage of fallout from the financial crisis on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. Highways, $27 billion. Computerized medical records, $19 billion. Fossil energy research, $3 billion. Turning the economy around? Priceless? Hardly. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers.
Feeling stimulated yet? We continue our coverage of fallout from the financial crisis this week with the Stim Pack. That's stimulus package, for those of you who speak plain English. Lots of compromises on Capitol Hill this week. Billions of dollars cut from the bill, billions added elsewhere, and maybe now we just cross our fingers. But what's in it for you and for me? And how does this all fit in with that big bank bailout from last October that made headlines again this week? Well, joining us to provide some answers are Marketplace Senior Editor Patty Hirsch and our D.C. Bureau Chief John Dimsdale. Hi, guys.
How are you doing?
Hello, Tess.
Gentlemen, first, let's talk about how much money we're looking at here. John, the stimulus package?
$790 billion. Now, you know, that's only a little more than where it started at first. During the debate, with all the add-ons and amendments, the bill was getting close to $1 trillion.
And, Patty, the bailout?
Well, you know, Tim Geithner was painting in pretty broad strokes when he talked last week about this, but we're looking at about $2.5 trillion.
Okay, so that's way beyond the original $700 billion bailout.
Oh, yes, way beyond that. I mean, we're talking about TARP when we talk about the 700, and there's still 350 left, but add it all up and we're looking at about $2.5 trillion.
All right, well, John, let's start with you. Let's talk a little bit about the stimulus package. Let's go through some of the help that the average American is going to get in this bill. Lots of tax cuts. Take us through these. First, the payroll.
Yeah, that's an individual income tax cut. It's one of President Obama's campaign promises, the Make Work Pay tax credit. Now, it has been trimmed back from the $500 per person to $400, and it's not given out in a lump sum. It's going to be given to you through your paycheck in the form of reduced withholding, and that's going to come to about $13 a week for the first year. It's a two-year break, but it's only worth about $7 a week next year. This tax cut begins to phase out for people earning more than $75,000 a year, but it is refundable, which means if you don't earn enough to pay $400 in taxes, you can file a 1040 form next year and get the difference in a check paid to you.
Okay, but other than that, nobody is getting a stimulus check like we saw last year.
Unless you're on Social Security, in which case you get a $250 check.
Okay, so that's a separate part of the stimulus package. You want to give us a few more details about that?
You also get a $250 check if you're a veteran with a pension, and disabled people have a $250 check.
One big thing I think everybody was hoping would happen here is we have another AMT patch, the alternative minimum tax.
That's right. And it's not really a stimulus because it basically keeps the status quo, but it shields middle-class families from the AMT, which would otherwise mean an average $2,300 tax increase, and that stayed in the compromise.
We've been getting a lot of questions from listeners about the first-time home buyer credit, and I think this is very confusing for folks. What was the final outcome on this?
Well, the compromise raises the existing $7,500 loan for first-time home buyers to an $8,000 tax credit, which means you don't have to pay it back. Now, this does only apply to a first home purchased before December 1st, so you got to get out there and start checking out those houses.
John, it seems to me that the main thrust of this is to try and get two things done. Firstly, to kind of create or retain jobs, and the second is to encourage more spending, both by companies and individuals. I mean, that seems to me to be the sum up of what the aim is here. Would you say that's right?
Exactly. Put some cash in people's pockets so that they'll be willing to go out to the mall, which didn't happen, you'll remember, last year with the big rebate.
Well, Patty, let's turn to you. What do we as individuals need to know about the rest of this bailout money?
Well, you know, we've been talking a lot about this here, and the way I like to think about it is that, you know, the president, he's got a shotgun that's loaded for bear, all right? Double-barrel shotgun with two cartridges, and the one cartridge is the stimulus package, and the other cartridge is the bank rescue plan, whatever you want to call it. And he needs to give this bear, if you like, this problem, he needs to give this bear both barrels at the same time. Because without the bank bailout package, the economy is likely to stagger in future. And without a rising and improving economy, well, the banks are likely not to survive. So the solution that's required is both of these things simultaneously at the same time, which is obviously means an enormous amount of money. I mean, we're talking $3+ trillion at this point.
But I think that's where all these questions come in from average Americans of why isn't this money coming to me? For example, nothing about loan modifications in the bailout package.
From Washington's point of view, you can't deal with mortgages and loans so easily. You have to pick winners and losers. If you're going to be helping one person, the neighbor's going to say, well, what about me? I've been paying all along. I should get some help, too. President Obama has said we will have some foreclosure relief down the road, but they haven't figured out how to do it yet.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're talking about $50 billion of the troubled asset relief plan to go towards dealing with foreclosures. But there's been no details of how that's going to work. And like John says, who do you pick? Frankly, if there was some guy living next door to me who took out a ridiculous loan that was no way he was ever going to be able to pay off at ridiculous rates, and he got bailed out and I didn't, I'm going to be pretty unhappy about that. So there are some really tough choices to make here.
And they've been trying to make those for months. So I guess the question is, is another month or two going to get us there?
I certainly don't know the answer to that. I speak to people on Wall Street every day. They're looking at next year at this point.
I think it'll be a while, yeah.
Well, John, before we go, let me just ask you, you know, we kind of reviewed a few of the tax credits earlier. Anything else people will want to be aware of out of the stimulus package?
Well, there are energy efficiency tax credits, $5 billion worth of them, incentives to weatherize your home, use alternative fuels, to buy a plug-in hybrid. There's also a $2,500 tax credit for college expenses, and that includes books and computers and tuition over the next 2 years. All of these have very strict income limits. There's an increase in unemployment benefits. $25 a week extends the benefits for another 20 weeks. There's more job training, more food stamps, more Head Start. And for anyone who's getting COBRA, the law that requires employers to keep former workers on the company's health care insurance policy, with presumably cheaper premiums than an unemployed person could get on their own. But those premiums are still very high, especially if you're unemployed. The stimulus bill offers a federal subsidy of 60% of that premium cost. So that's really a major benefit for the newly unemployed who could be paying $1,000 a month for health care.
Marketplace's Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale and our senior editor Patty Hirsch. Thanks, guys, so much for helping us out this week.
Been a pleasure.
Thanks, Tess.
We mentioned that the Obama administration is looking at further solutions to the housing crisis. Well, in the meantime, several banks, including JPMorgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, and Citigroup, say they're going to stop all home foreclosures for the next 90 days.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers. And by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at saveandinvest.org.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. It's time for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story, and with me is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Tess. So what are we talking about today?
So we have the stimulus package, lots of things in it, lots of things not. What do you think this does for the average American?
I think it's good news. Now, full disclosure, Tess, I'm in the camp that isn't upset about the long-term spending in there. I think improving the electricity grid and education, all these things, is for the good. And overall, it's a good step to prevent a recession turning into a depression, which is really what we're talking about, right?
Yeah, it certainly is. I wonder, though, I think when most people look at this plan, they're going to wonder really what's in it for them right away. It doesn't look like there's a whole lot of short-term stimulus to get people, say, back in the stores or, you know, is spending in other ways. It's going to be something on the order of $13 a week more in our paychecks.
That's right. And the other aspect that I would criticize is that it's really not enough support to state and local governments. But again, it still is a step forward. And there will be also action on the banking side. And we're also seeing some slight signs where, you know, a lot of the action by the Fed does seem to be having some sort of an impact on the banking system.
Well, speaking of the banking system, we also had news on the bank bailout front this week. But I want to particularly ask you not about the details of what the Fed and the Treasury Department have decided to do. I want to talk instead about a lot of the listener letters and comments that we're getting asking why we shouldn't just divvy up the $700 billion and send checks directly to taxpayers. And I did the math, 700 billion divided by 300 million people. It's about $2,300 per man, woman, and child.
Right, $2,300. So it's really not that much money. And then if you want to get into bigger sums, for example, one of the proposals that we got was $100,000 because you really want to go out to those mortgages, right?
Right.
And then you're talking about $20 trillion. It's a little bit crazy there. There is this intuitive appeal to it, but then it starts getting into the situation about renters bailing out homeowners. The unfairness really becomes apparent very quickly, plus you lose sight of the goal to get a well-functioning financial system. And the other thing is there are other ways to do a test that are more in line with incentives and our tax system. For example, you want to accomplish this, how about getting rid of the payroll tax for a while? Now, that put money into people's pocket, and I don't think there's quite as much unfairness.
I suppose there's unfairness in just about any proposal because, I mean, if you cut the payroll tax, you're not really helping anyone who doesn't have a job.
Exactly. Here's the other question that I would have. Why not just forgive everyone's debt?
Chris, what if you don't forgive the debt, but you actually use this bailout money to pay it off?
Then the question then becomes the huge sums of money because your $2,300, it doesn't get you to anywhere in terms of sending it out to people. So in order to really make a difference in sending it out to people, you're starting to talk about an enormous magnitude.
Are you really serious that you don't think $2,300 per every man, woman, and child is very much money?
Yes, it is a lot of money. But for addressing the situation, I don't think this is the right way to go about it.
Fair enough. Thanks so much, Chris, and we'll talk to you later on in the show.
All right, and I expect to get lots of criticism, and I'm looking forward to it.
And compliments, I'm sure.
And compliments, I hope.
Got all kinds of money to spend on your sweetie this weekend? How about spending it on something completely useless?
No, what that is, it's a perfume bottle.
Oh.
And it doesn't even come with the perfume.
How nice. That story's next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Looks like even Cupid is no match for the troubled economy. A National Retail Federation survey says Valentine's Day spending will likely drop this year for the first time since 2005, from last year's average of $123 to $102.50. Of course, not all consumers were created average. Marketplace's Sean Cole recently looked into what the other half spends on Valentine's Day, or rather, the other 1%.
I talked with Jim Trippon.
So I'm Jim Trippon. I'm the advisor to America's Millionaires.
He's a CPA in Houston. He has 400 clients, all of them millionaires, some of them uber millionaires. And every year around this time, Trippon releases his list of the 10 most outrageously expensive Valentine's Day gifts in the world.
Yeah, we call them the ultimate list of Valentine's gifts, or sometimes we call it the world's most expensive Valentine's gifts.
We're talking anywhere from a $48 million private jet to a $40 bottle of spring water.
Bling water.
Both of which were on the list in 2007. This year, the most expensive item on the list
is an authentic Templar Knight castle in Tuscany. And you can pick that up for the cheap price of only 11 million euros.
Or $14 million.
Yeah, but that's completely renovated, of course. You don't have to redo the kitchen or anything.
Well, that's a savings, isn't it?
There you go.
I was relieved we could laugh about this. Tripon isn't some jerk celebrating conspicuous consumption. In fact, he says there's a message to his madness, at least partly.
The point of coming out with the list was that if money is no object, I'll show you the ultimate gifts you can buy for Valentine's Day. But if buying something on this list would cause you to fight about money the rest of the year, then maybe you want to be a little more cautious about your spending.
So it's really sort of a cautionary exercise.
Right. But if you have unlimited funds, we've got some great stuff on our list.
About a third of the items come from high-end magazines and shops, but the other two-thirds come directly from his clients.
They say, Jim, you know, you really ought to put this on the list because this is something that we're going to do.
Which is where number two came from this year, Isla Bonita, a $2.6 million island off of Brazil.
One of my clients was looking for a vacation property. And so they were looking at a variety of islands throughout, you know, this part of the world.
And is your client buying it as a Valentine's Day gift?
They were certainly talking about it.
The rest of this year's list is what you might expect, a $60,000 watch, a $9,600 cell phone. Some of the items were so fancy, I couldn't even tell what they were at first. Bond number 9 crystallized amphora. Is that a watch?
No, no. What that is, it's a perfume bottle.
Oh.
And it doesn't even come with the perfume. But it is covered with small, very tiny diamonds.
So it's like a perfume decanter?
Exactly.
And now, a special Valentine's Day message to my girlfriend. Baby, if for some reason I present you with a 42-ounce, $3,500 perfume decanter, please murder me with it. Let's return to the Marketplace Money story already in progress.
Other than the island this year, our average price has moved down a little bit from years past.
So the economic downturn might even be affecting the absurdly rich. Plus, they're looking at more substantial investment-type gifts this year. The question is there more sentiment in a $60,000 watch than in a $60 watch or a $6 watch? Tripon says it's all a matter of scale.
And to them, if they gave something less than that, it may not show that they really had that much commitment. And as silly as that may sound, you know, they're really flying at a different altitude than the rest of us.
They certainly are, because that does sound extremely silly.
But, you know, it's only 1 week's income, so what's the big deal?
I'll tell you what the big deal is, said almost all of the people I stopped on the street in Boston last Sunday.
A car soup of Valentine's Day? That's crazy.
It seems a little outrageous.
I think it's crazy.
I think it's outrageous.
Ridiculous.
I think it's ridiculous.
I think that's really crazy.
Then again, said these very same people.
If you got the money, spend it. You know what I mean?
I guess that's true.
Stimulates the economy, so, well, depends whose economy, but yeah.
This was in a busy shopping area, and a few of these folks were busily shopping for Valentine's gifts themselves. One of them carried a $100 pair of sneakers for his girlfriend of 5 years. He was 19 years old.
Do you think that, like, you can sort of bespeak love with a castle? Do you know what I mean?
Like, I don't think so. Not with a castle.
No.
Maybe an island, though. Maybe an island, I think so.
And that's the thing about this list. If you look at it long enough, you think, wouldn't it be great if I could buy stuff like this, whether or not I ever would? Wouldn't it be great if I never had to worry about money again? That's a reality for some people.
Money allows them freedom from not having choices. You know, if they have a health crisis, they can get the best doctor. They can get the best of whatever it may be.
And I guess that's what I'm saying is, like, I can totally understand, like, getting Cadillac healthcare with your money if you have that kind of money. But what I don't understand is buying somebody a jet for Valentine's Day.
Well, then get the island this year.
And now, another special Valentine's Day message to my girlfriend. I love you. In Boston, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace Money.
Aw, that's sweet. Well, on the other end of the spending spectrum, some stocks are selling for less than a foot long at Subway. What better time to buy shares for the folks who are truly in it for the long run? Kids! There's very little to lose and a lot to learn. Sally Herships has more.
Some people idolize rock stars. For others, it's actors. But for 14-year-old Alex France, Warren Buffett is the man.
How bad do you want to meet with Warren Buffett?
It would be a dream come true. It would be awesome.
Like Warren Buffett, Alex and his mom Sylvia live in Omaha. They've actually seen the billionaire investor at the Dairy Queen. And like Buffett, Alex is interested in getting an early start on his investing. So his mom is taking advantage of the Wall Street roller coaster to teach him about the market. And Alex is hooked. He's got his eye on a company that produces steel for construction.
With Obama looking to spend a lot of money on building infrastructure, that looks like a good investment.
One that Alex hopes to take advantage of. He's trying to talk his mom into letting him and his brother pool their cash to buy stocks. Sylvia wants her son to save his money for a car. But she admits, with so many stocks undervalued, it's a great time to buy. After all, Alex has years to make up for any bad bets.
The old adage goes, no guts, no glory. With any kind of possible profits, there's always some inherent risk.
This is the sale of a century. We're talking Circuit City clearances here.
That's Andrew Ng. He's a professor of finance and economics at Columbia Business School. He's also the parent of a newborn girl. So naturally, he's thinking of the future. And he says, now is the right time to buy, if it's for the long term.
You see all these headlines, and they're all real. It's very scary. But the economy will recover. Companies will be generating cash. And in the long run, these things will pay off.
But even when you've got years to see returns, picking stocks can still be risky. It's hard to know why a stock's price drops. Ng says it can be a few reasons. Antsy investors or an unpredictable economy.
We just don't know, but that's why you want to mitigate that risk and you want to hold a big portfolio. And there are very easy ways to do that. In fact, you can go and buy a mutual fund or an index mutual fund that holds for you a large number of stocks.
New Yorker Alessandro Siciliano is doing just that, spreading out his risk.
One share of Coke, 6 shares of GE, and was that it?
Well, he also has a share of Apple. His mom, Rosemary, bought it for him at Christmas. And ever since, the two have been following the market closely and making buys. Alessandro reads the business news every day.
And how old are you?
I'm 14.
This is a kid who's been listening to Steve Jobs' keynote address in its entirety since he was 8 years old.
I got my Apple when I was in like fourth grade.
And he's owned a couple of iPods. It's all part of Rosemary's investment strategy. Buy what you know.
I thought that it would be better for Alessandro to buy products and things that he uses.
Alessandro's mom says this year's events have taught him a lot. He's learned about compound interest and how to calculate percentages. And over in Omaha, Sylvia says her son, Alex, has learned too.
It's a great time just to learn in good times and in bad times rather than studying it in books.
Definitely. It's a topic that we can speak on at the table. It's something that brings us together as a family.
I know that sounds kind of corny, but it is true.
And it looks like Alex is ready to tackle Wall Street. He just won his high school stock market game, hauling in $13,000 imaginary dollars. He even beat his teachers. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers. And by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com.
It is that time in the show when we take your personal finance calls and your questions. And joining me once again is our personal finance expert, Chris Farrell. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Des.
So let's go straight to an email from Jennifer. She lives in Green Bay, Wisconsin, and she has about $10,000 in a CD and $4,000 in some bills that she would like to get rid of. She spoke with a loan officer at her bank who said that for 2% above the CD rate, she could take out a loan against the value of the CD. I did not know that you could do this. Is that indeed the case, and is it a good idea?
It seems like a good idea to me. Just a couple things. One, so I assume it's going to be a $4,000 loan. You're going to pay the loan off right away. And then the other question I'd raise, Tess, is when you break a CD contract, there are various early withdrawal penalties. Well, take a look at what would be the cost of the early withdrawal penalty versus borrowing this money in paying that interest rate.
And I guess a lot of that would depend on what kind of interest rate she already has on that CD, because most CDs right now you're getting a paltry 2, maybe 3%. So then if you're paying 2% interest, what good is that at all?
Exactly. So, and I don't know whether it's a one-year CD or a five-year CD. So there's lots of things that can go into that. But the bottom line is, what way do you come out ahead?
So do the math. There you go. Hope that helps, Jennifer. Shirley wrote to us from Jacksonville, Florida, and she's got a first and second mortgage on her home. But as we hear so often these days, she was recently laid off. Now, Shirley thinks that she can pay her much larger mortgage, her first mortgage, like she usually does, but she's really worried about the second. So her question is, what happens if she gets behind on her second mortgage? Could they come after her home for both the second and the first? How would this work?
Well, remember, a second mortgage is you borrowed against the home. The home is the collateral. If you fall behind, they can start foreclosure proceedings.
Yikes.
If you stop paying your second mortgage, they can file for foreclosure, and then it's kind of a nightmare scenario after that. So here's my main recommendation for everybody. And I know it's not going to work in all circumstances. You're worried about falling behind? Start talking to the bank. Write everything down so that you can show that you've been aggressive, you've addressed this issue. And if you are getting into a situation where you are going to end up defaulting or falling behind or having trouble with your second mortgage, you probably need an attorney at that point to help you out.
Good advice always. All right, let's go to the phones. And Caroline is with us from Seattle, Washington. Hi, Caroline.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. I believe that we've spoken before.
Yeah, I sent in a question last May. I had some money that I had saved up, and I was wondering whether I should use it to pay down my second mortgage or whether I should start a Roth IRA with it.
All right, and what did Chris tell you at that point?
He told me to go ahead with my gut instinct and pay down my second mortgage, which I did do. And I'm really, really glad I followed his advice now. I've just finished paying off that mortgage entirely, and it's really nice not to have that hanging over my head anymore.
But I understand that things are not all good for you right now.
Well, I found out that I'm going to lose my job next month, and that's pretty scary. I have a severance and I have some unemployment and I can live for, I have a little bit of a cushion, but at least, you know, I won't have that second mortgage hanging over my head. And, you know, I had put that money into a Roth IRA. I just wonder if it would be worth anything at all right now.
Yeah.
Boy, Chris, here we are again. Job loss number two, just in this portion of Getting Personal. Any advice, once again, for Caroline in terms of what she should be doing to prepare for this layoff?
Well, Carol, you sound pretty prepared as it is. You know, one of the things that I've really learned, and I think this is a different about this downturn than some previous downturns, is you can get an awful lot of good information on the web about how to shrink your bills, how to cut back on spending, and activating your network to find a job as quickly as possible. And we got our fingers crossed for you.
I actually have an interview this afternoon, so please wish me good luck.
We will definitely keep our fingers crossed for you. And Caroline, let us know how it turns out, okay?
Thank you.
Thanks so much for the call. And finally, Chris, we've been getting a whole lot of emails dealing with a question that you took last week. This was about student loans and the amount, $90,000, that a young woman had taken out to finance her fine arts education. Her mother asked us if there was any way to refinance her private student loans. And Chris, your answer seemed a little harsh to a lot of our listeners. You want to explain this?
Well, there's a couple of things. One, there's a lot of flexibility built into the federal student loan system. But when it comes to the private student loan system, there's a lot less flexibility in terms of restructuring that loan. And the lender has a lot more power just to say no. The other thing that I want to emphasize is this is an awful lot of debt tests. Now, look, when you enter a career, you can get a pretty good idea, what's the pay scale? If I borrow this much, does it justify this pay? If you can't make that work, I don't think you should borrow that much, or you got to come up with a different way to get into that career.
There you go. Hope that answers some of your follow-up questions from last week. If you've got some questions that need clarification, do visit our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link there. Or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And we'll be back with more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Student loans weren't the only topic that got you all hot and bothered enough to write in. Time for some more listener letters, and let's go long on this one. Long term. Recently, we talked with author Roger Lowenstein about how important it is for investors to focus on the long term when dabbling in the stock market. Gary Leach of Prescott, Arizona, called in to reiterate that it's way easier said than done.
Time and time again, my wife and I have been shown the long term, 20-year outlook of our diversified portfolios, and intellectually, we get it. Viscerally, however, the last several months have been a punch to the gut. And when one is in pain, the intellect has a very rough go making its point.
Here's something else that's easier said than done, that do-it-yourself project languishing in the basement. We recently aired a story on how hiring folks to help with those projects just might be more efficient than the DIY part. Sarah Wormiel of Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts, disagreed.
So some people screw up. That doesn't mean people should always hire someone to do everything for them. People should be encouraged to be self-reliant. And if they screw up, they'll learn something.
But Michael Covington of Athens, Georgia, must have his own experience with DIY gone wrong, because he knows the true downside.
The real problem with do-it-yourself is that you can't spread the risk among multiple jobs. If you're a professional, you can build the risk into your charges so that when you have to fix up an expensive mishap, you can absorb the cost. If you're a do-it-yourselfer and the expensive mishap happens, you're sunk.
In last week's Straight Story, Chris and I jawed over the mishaps that sank a couple of Obama administration nominees. Tax mishaps. Chris advocated for simplifying the tax code. Many of you wrote in to point out that the issues involved in those scuttled nominations weren't terribly complex. But Phil Nickel of Longmont, Colorado, thinks maybe there's a way to get tax reform back on the national agenda. He writes, why not mandate that all members of Congress do their own taxes with a pencil, paper, and a calculator? And if they run into trouble, they can call the public IRS helpline. I like that idea, and I'm guessing Nina Olson would too. She's the National Taxpayer Advocate, and we spoke with her a few weeks back about why taxes are so hard and why the IRS is so mean. But David Ashland of Troy, Michigan, called in defense of the tax man.
The IRS has found errors on my tax returns that favored me financially, and they have refunded the money immediately. Often the IRS is viewed by the public as being adversarial. They're simply doing their job, and I believe they're doing it well.
Safe to say he won't be getting audited anytime soon. We're happy to get your comments, so if you have something to say, click on the contact button on our website. It's marketplace.org. Can't find a job? You might want to rethink your skill set, but for military veterans, that can be pretty tough.
My job when I was in the Army was to destroy enemy munitions. There's not really much call for doing that in the civilian sector.
You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. States were allotted a little over $53 billion from the stimulus package, but many are still waiting on exactly what education and healthcare benefits they'll get. In Oregon, the budget debate has arrived on the doorstep of people caring for sick family members. Ethan Lindsay reports from Oregon Public Broadcasting.
Rusty Brown's 42 years old. He lives in a cramped mobile home on the outskirts of Eugene, Oregon. He doesn't talk much, and he needs a walker to get around. Rusty took a 75-foot fall when he was a teen. Now he's considered 100% disabled. And so his brother Christopher takes care of him.
He's very cool for the most part. Well, you know, like you get crabby at each other. Sometimes he wants to do something completely different than what needs to be done.
Christopher dresses Rusty and bathes him. They sleep in the same room. But Christopher has some official responsibilities.
The tasks are defined as followed. Okay, eating, dressing, grooming, bathing, personal hygiene, mobility, bowel and bladder, and
taking care of his brother isn't just a responsibility. It's his job. At the end of the month, Christopher Brown will get a check from the state for his work.
Sometimes it's pretty slacker, but sometimes it's not, too. My other brothers all have kids and families and wives. I sacrifice that to take care of him.
In the early 1980s, Oregon became the first state to use Medicaid money to pay in-home care workers. Basically, if you have a sick or disabled family member, you can apply to the state to get paid under their Medicaid coverage as an independent contractor. People who aren't blood relatives can also be home health care workers. There are 10,000 people doing this work. Many other states have followed Oregon's lead. But low wages and no benefits initially led to high turnover and poor care. So the state of Oregon decided to raise the level of professionalism. Helen Moss is an instructor at the Labor Education and Research Center at the University of Oregon.
Oregon is a pioneer in this. People start out sometimes working with a loved one, a relative, discover they like the work, stay on, and try and make a living at it. And you know, those are definitely the people, you know, you want to keep.
Home care workers are now unionized. They can get health care coverage, make a bit more than minimum wage, and receive professional training.
Okay. How about computer/internet access? Need it?
On a recent winter weekend, 20 home care workers cram into a small hotel conference room in Portland.
Okay, and that's, again, one of those things. It's going to depend a lot on your work.
These classes teach people a whole range of things. One class is about managing a personal budget. Another is about preventing injuries when doing things like lifting a client into the bathtub. William Douglas teaches a class called Keeping It Professional.
And we talk about boundary issues. And those are things that someone like, if they were working for a GM or Ford or McDonald's even, they're going to get on-the-job training and then continuing education. And this helps people enhance their profession.
But no profession is recession-proof. The state of Oregon confronts a $1 billion shortfall. There's one proposal on the table that would cut about half the jobs for home care workers. Back at the Brown family trailer, Christopher says the cutbacks would be hard. The union told him he might lose his job. He says he'd still care for Rusty, but he adds he'd have to go find another job to pay the bills.
I don't see any reason to modify a program like this that already works, and it's already about as cheap as it can be. You don't need to pay me anymore. Or, you know, if they wanted to pay me less, you know, I mean, we could talk about it, but... You know, I don't want to lose my job.
Christopher Brown says he used to work at a home for the disabled. That's before he got paid to take care of his brother. And Brown says facilities like those cost more and provide worse care. So why, he asks, would the state want to go back? In Eugene, Oregon, I'm Ethan Lindsay for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
And we're back with Getting Personal, and Chris is back with us. And Chris, as you know, next week we're dedicating the entire hour to issues of personal finance in the military. So we thought we'd give a bit of a preview of that and take some calls from members of the armed forces. And John is on the line from Pensacola, Florida. Hi, John.
Hi.
So are you still a member of the armed forces?
Yes, I am.
Which branch are you in?
I'm in the Navy, and I've been in for about 15 years now.
And what do you do?
I'm a naval air crewman. I ride in the back of P3s and operate the radar.
Well, what can we help you scope out? What's your question for Chris?
Well, I'm going to spend a full 20 years in the Navy, possibly more, and I'll be able to retire with 50% of my base pay. I'm also contributing to TSP.
And the TSP is the government's thrift savings program, right?
Yes, it is. Before the big market crash, I suppose you'd say, I had about $25,000 in it, and also, before the crash, I borrowed $10,000 from it to start a biodiesel business. The question I have is, I just don't know how to figure out how much I need to save in order to maintain my current lifestyle.
Boy, Chris, you know, this is a really common question, trying to figure out what you need to save for retirement. What's your recommendation here?
Well, there's a couple of thoughts. One, the military has one of the best retirement systems out there. And then with the thrift savings plan, the TSP above that, it's up to the market gods, whether it goes higher, whether it stays where it is. But you'll have some gain that comes from that. So, John, if you want to be more systematic about it, there's a really helpful website, analyzenow.com. And it has this free program for figuring out this very question. You put in the pension amount, and you go through your expenses, and you play with the numbers a bit. But it'll give you a pretty good picture of what you might need for retirement. But my bottom line, you should be in a very good position, really, to set yourself up for another stage of life, which I imagine you'll be earning an income during that period of time, too.
Yes, I will.
John, will you be retiring from everything? Once you hit 60 or just from the military?
Just from the military.
So, Chris, that certainly makes a difference as well.
It makes a big difference. I mean, I guess one way to look at it is, let's say, and you just pick when you're going to retire, but let's just say 20 years, you get 50% of your base pay. Then the question is, where does the other 50% come from?
Mm-hmm.
But at least you have that baseline that you can operate from.
So does that help you out?
Yes, it does.
Well, thanks so much for the call.
Thank you guys so much.
Well, Chris, Sarah is on the line from Washington, D.C. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
What is your role in the military?
I am a spouse.
A spouse. So what does your husband do?
He is currently recovering at Walter Reed. He was injured in Iraq a year ago in December.
Wow.
And we rapidly relocated from southern Georgia up to the Washington area.
How is he doing?
He's doing great. He's getting back into shape. He's going back to work part-time. And we will be moving in May so that he can attend an Army graduate school in Syracuse, New York.
Good for him. So he's planning to stay in the military.
He is. As an amputee, he is given the choice about whether or not he wants to stay in the Army or be medically retired. And he's been in the Army 11 years. So we have hit the point where it would take a lot for him to find a job that provides similar benefits with a similar paycheck. I mean, there's some things that are really challenging about it, like it took him getting blown up for us to be able to cohabitate 50% of our marriage, but you know, you could have a lot of separations in the corporate world, too.
So what is he hoping to do then?
He is going to be moving out of the infantry and actually over to the finance world. This program that he'll be attending is the Army's premier finance program. He will come out with two master's degrees. One in business administration and one in public administration. When he retires, he'll be in a much better position to find a job in the civilian world.
Sure, sure. Well, so you're going to have a money manager in the family within a few months, but I guess in the meantime, you have a question. So.
I actually have two questions that kind of fit together, and they specifically relate to our move. The rental property situation in Syracuse is pretty grim, and our family includes three small dogs and a toddler, so a home without a yard is not an option. We are afraid that we're going to be forced to buy a house in Syracuse. So our question is it worth pursuing a conventional loan and saving our VA loan guarantee? And question number two is, given the fact that we're going to be moving progressively quicker, the more senior my husband becomes, what can we do to protect ourselves? Is we're perhaps put in a position where every 18 months or so, we might be forced to buy a house.
Complex question, Chris. What do you think?
Well, it is. When I was growing up, my dad was in the Navy, and we moved. It was every 2 years. Have you been to Syracuse yourself?
We are going to Syracuse the first weekend of March. We have been connected with a realtor who has been very helpful and very realistic. Her feeling is that potentially we could, you know, put the house on the market and find a buyer, you know, in the period of time after we would leave. And if we opted not to put the house on the market, she feels confident that we could find tenants.
Right. But you're taking on an awful lot of risk. Even in a booming market, 18 months is a really short period of time to own. So I would just be extremely scared of you owning a home. And if the rental market's not that good for you coming in, imagine what it's going to be like if you end up owning a property and trying to rent it and manage it from a distance as you go to different parts of the country or even overseas. What if you took a longer commute, which would be a terrible thing over 18 months, but is that practical? What if you took an apartment and did a deal with a local farmer not too far away so your dogs have a place to stay and run around and you spend time visiting them all the time? A home that's in foreclosure that a bank wants someone to live there for a period of time. I just think that your instincts are, this is really not a good idea. And it would pay for you to actually pay extra money on rental to avoid having the deadweight cost of a home that you might not be able to sell.
Well, that's in line with what we were thinking. It's just,
yeah,
it's a rotten situation to be in.
Well, please do share our thanks and our admiration with your husband. We wish you both absolutely the very best, and let us know how it works out.
Okay, I'll do it. I appreciate the guidance that you offer.
Well, Chris, as we said, next week we are devoting the entire hour to the unique personal finance situations faced by members of the armed forces. So please join us next week for our special coverage, Debt of Service. But as always, we are answering your questions every weekday online at marketplace.org. Just click on the Getting Personal link there. Or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Chris, thanks as always for the terrific advice.
Thanks, Tess. Talk to you later.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Imagine facing today's economy after getting back from a long tour in Iraq or Afghanistan. The unemployment rate among active duty veterans coming home from those wars is 2% higher than for civilians. New Yorker Stephen Kraft worked at MTV before joining the Army after 9/11. He left the military 4 years ago and says he's been looking for a steady job pretty much ever since.
My name is Stephen Kraft. I served with the U.S. Army 82nd Airborne Division from 2002 until 2005. And from 2003 to 2004, I served in Iraq. After I left the military, I figured getting a job was going to be easy. I had a bachelor's degree. I had 4 years of professional experience in the civilian world. I had just gotten back from 3 years in the military, including a year in combat. I thought I was going to be a prime candidate for any job I wanted. And unfortunately, that didn't seem to be the case. So this is what my resume looks like for the past couple of years. February 2005. Since I've been out of the Army, I've had four or five different jobs. 2005, I worked for MTV Networks. I worked at MTV. Project coordinator.
I was one of the first to be laid off.
From January of 2007
until... I worked for a construction company. Work slowed down. I got laid off.
From January of 2008...
I worked for Brookfield Properties. Funding went away for the job. In one day, I lost my job.
I've been on unemployment, looking for jobs, and... just struggling to get my bills paid.
Coming home in any economy is tough, but coming home right now, I think, is especially difficult. My name is Paul Rykoff. I'm the executive director and founder of IAVA, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. Among Iraq veterans and Afghanistan veterans in the active duty military, the unemployment rate was over 8% in 2007, and it might be even higher now.
Are they here yet? Not that early.
For the past couple of weeks on Fridays, I've been meeting up with a group of other veterans. This Friday, we're going to Barcade in Brooklyn. They have pool tables. They have arcade games.
So I was just talking about how I owe you an answer about your resume.
We just talk about military life, post-military life, job hunting, talk about that.
There's an opening where I work that I think you would be in the running for the position. It's a supervisory position, and they want X amount of experience supervising people, which you have.
It's not an easy process to get people to understand what exactly you did in the military and how that can help an organization.
I would recommend tailoring your resume exactly to that job description.
Thank you. My job when I was in the Army was to destroy enemy munitions. You know, there's not really much call for, you know, doing that in the civilian sector.
61% of employers said in a recent study that they do not have a complete understanding of the qualifications ex-service members offer.
You know, I had a resume that showed that I had leadership experience under the most hostile of conditions. Combine that with just the service to my country. You know, I know a lot of employers say that they like to see service of some sort. Some sort of volunteerism is always good on a resume. I was like, well, here's the ultimate in volunteerism. I volunteered 3 years of my life to, you know, this country's cause.
2009 is going to be the year where we either repeat the mistakes of Vietnam and we have high rates of unemployment, incarceration, drug and alcohol abuse, or we go back to what we had after World War II, where you have comprehensive job programs, you have educational benefits like the GI Bill, and you create a greatest generation.
Before I joined the Army, I had like three jobs from the time I was 16 until I was 28. Now here I was, I couldn't hold a job. You know, I started, you know, wondering if the military cursed me. Did my Army service make it that much harder for me? Like, oh,
Right? He was in the military, put it in that pile.
And the thing I'll tell these folks is that, you know, I've been there, we've all been there, and at the end of the day, it's still better than getting shot at in a war zone. If you can get through that and you can get home alive, you can get through this job market.
That was military veteran Stephen Kraft of New York City with Paul Rykoff of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. Our story was produced by Ann Hepperman and Kara Oler. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, our special hour on personal finance and the military. We'll hear from a soldier wounded by a grenade in Afghanistan who still believes the Army is a great career.
It's another job, just like any other job. Except for you have the bonus of a deployment.
We'll also look at career challenges for those married to the military, plus how the Navy is making sure soldiers are financially fit for battle.
We have to be physically ready, do so many push-ups, so many sit-ups, and run. We need to have the same kind of standards from a financial perspective. We need to have financial stand-down.
Tune in next week for Debt of Service, Stories of Money and the Military. Marketplace Money's producers include Stephen Hoffman, Eve Tro, and Allison Gilbert. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vegland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something from Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the Internet and log on to our website. The information you need is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers.
American Public Media.